Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joel chapter 3, which I will entitle The Lord Judges the Nations in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. A little bit of background. Joel prophesying at a time. Nobody knows when. The scholars all disagree. In chapter 2, he talked about the day of the Lord. We decided that the day of the Lord referred to what the Romans did to not only the apostate Jewish kingdom in AD 70, but also what the Romans had done to them when they almost collapsed in AD 68 to 69. There was a lot of evidence in chapter 2 that Joel was aiming at AD 70, prophesying about AD 70. The majority of my commentators said so. Of course, they were not futurists. They were writing before the rise of dispensationalism, but I think they're right. And the evidence, I thought, was pretty strong. And so I'm going to use chapter 2 as context for chapter 3 because the evidence about what the Valley of Jehoshaphat is not very clear. It's very difficult. With that background, we begin with verse 1 of Joel 3. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. Now this restoration, I've got 7 options as to when the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem were restored. Option number 1, from their captivity in AD 70 to 1948, one of my commentators suggested. Option number 2, when the Jews returned from Babylon, they had their fortunes restored when they rebuilt the temple. This is the opinion of the commentators Benson and Poole. And Benson and Poole also say that this return from Babylon to Jerusalem is a type of the turning to Jesus at the beginning of the church age. Option number 3, as to when the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem are restored, when the Christian church is established. Notice in verse 1, the restoration of Judah is at that time, in those days and at that time. That refers back to chapter 2, and as I said, chapter 2 seems to me very clear to refer to AD 70, as well as Pentecost, because of the famous passage in Joel 2:28, verse 32, which you will recognize from Peter's Pentecostal sermon. After this, I will pour out my spirit on all humanity. Then your sons and your daughters will prophesy. Your old men will have dreams and your young men will see visions, etc., etc. And then in chapter 3, verse 1, Joel says, in those days and at that time, referring to Pentecost and also AD 70 because of the wonders in the heavens on the earth, blood, fire, and columns of smoke that Peter mentioned, quoting Joel. And so the fortunes of the Judah and Jerusalem, the old Jerusalem, are restored in the new Jerusalem, the church, when the old Jerusalem gets whacked in AD 70. Now, Barnes and Calvin have a similar idea. They say the restoration of the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem occur after the return from Babylon in 538 or so, all the way to the first advent. Then you have the changeover from the old Jerusalem to the new Jerusalem in the Christian church, and then all the way to the second advent. So the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem were restored continually from 538 all the way to the end of time. That's Calvin and Barnes' idea. I think that's stretched a little bit. I think it's referring to the establishment of the Christian church myself, option 3. Now, here are a couple of local options. Historical fulfillments closer to the time of Joel. Option number 5, the Maccabees. They restored the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, and that was 2nd century B.C., after Joel, of course, who's 8th century B.C., so that could be it, but I don't think that's of all that great historical significance, really, not compared to the establishment of the church. Option number 6, the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem were restored when certain events happened to the Persian Emperor Cambyses II, who ruled from 529 to 522, and he ruled Egypt in 522. This is what Adam Clark says. Cambyses II's unfortunate expedition to Egypt, the destruction of 50,000 of his troops by the moving pillars of sand, whom he had sent across the desert to plunder the rich temple of Jupiter Ammon, his return to Judea, and dying of a wound which he received from his own sword in mounting his horse. What a way for an emperor to die. Stabbed himself, climbing on his horse. That happened at the foot of Mount Carmel in Israel. And then his army, composed of different nations, seeing themselves without a head, fell out and fought against each other till the whole were destroyed. And thus, of course, Israel doesn't have to worry about Cambyses II anymore. I think that's a real stretch. Although it's interesting, that's why I mentioned it. Well, that's option number 6 as to how God restored the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. Let's look at option number 7, the end of the world. God will restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem when he creates a millennial kingdom, or maybe when he restores the Jews in the final state, the eternal state. Here's what Adam Clark says. The prophecy in this chapter is thought by some to relate to the latter times of the world, when God shall finally deliver his people from all their adversaries. And it must be confessed that the figures employed are so lofty as to render it impossible to restrain the whole of their import to any events prior to the commencement of the Christian era. Well, I would agree with that, but you could say that the events mentioned here refer to the beginning of the Christian era, maybe not prior to the beginning of the Christian era, but to the beginning, the establishment of the church. Clark continues, the whole prophecy is delivered in a very beautiful strain of poetry. By what particular events are referred to is at present very uncertain. That's why I have 7 options. In this painful uncertainty, rendered still more so by the discordant opinions of many wise and learned men, it appears to be my province, as I have nothing in the form of a new conjecture to offer, to confine myself to an explanation of the phraseology of the chapter, and leave then the reader to apply it as may seem best to his own judgment. In other words, Adam Clark punted. He did mention that some people say it refers to the end of the world. I don't think so. I think it refers to the beginning of the church. Whether the return from Babylon is a type of that, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. The ultimate point of it is that the church is established, and that's how the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem are restored. And to a greater or lesser extent, I have Benson, Poole, Calvin backing me up on that. Barnes also. Now let's look at this expression, if you behold in those days and at that time. Let's take a futurist, in fact a pre-trib dispensational futurist, and let's look at his arguments. This is a gentleman named Heathley. I think his first name is Hampton Heathley. Sounds like a lawyer. Here is a series of arguments he uses to show that this fulfillment could not have happened in the past any time. First of all, argument number 1, God has not restored the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. In verse 1, God says, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. Mr. Heathley says, God hasn't done that yet. Well, I just gave you 5 non-futurist arguments where God did restore the fortunes, mainly by establishing the church. Argument number 2 from the futurist, Mr. Heathley, God has not judged all the nations, as he said he was going to do in verse 2, which we haven't gotten to yet. God says in verse 2, I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. I will enter into judgment with them because of my people, my inheritance, Israel. Well, I'm going to argue when I get to verse 2 that God did judge the nations of the Roman Empire in AD 70 because the Roman Empire had a whole heap of problems too, just like the Jews did right around that time of the Jewish War. Argument number 3, says Mr. Heathley, the futurist, Jerusalem is certainly not holy today because they're still looking for their Messiah. In chapter 3, verse 17 of Joel, in this chapter, we read, then you will know that I am Yahweh your God who dwells in Zion, my holy mountain. Jerusalem will be holy and foreigners will never overrun it again. Ah, well, say the futurist, says Mr. Heathley, God, through Joel, says that Jerusalem will be holy. Well, we know Jerusalem's not holy today. There are no Christians over there. They're all secular. Verse 17 in Joel 3 says, Jerusalem will be holy. Foreigners will never overrun it again. Well, that's happening. You know, we don't have people who believe and so forth. Well, but Zion, the new Israel, the church, is not still looking for the Messiah. Foreigners will never overrun the true Israel anymore. Argument number 4 for the futurist. Strangers will pass through no more. But invasions are still happening to Israel. A couple of examples. 1991, Scud missile attacks by Saddam Hussein on Jerusalem. And of course, now Israel has the Iron Dome. But just recently, in fact, this month, October 7th, 2023, the Palestinian terror organization Hamas sneak attacked Israel and murdered more Jews since the Holocaust. So, says the futurist argument, see there? Invasions are still happening, but Joel in verse 17 of chapter 3 says, strangers will pass through no more. Foreigners will never overrun Israel again. Well, the answer to that is, foreigners are no longer passing through the new Israel, the church. Argument number 5 from the futurist. Verse 10 of this chapter, chapter 3, implies that there is a peace in the land that is temporary and Soon the people of the land will resort back to war, will return to war. Joel 3:10 says, "Beat your plows into swords and your pruning knives into spears. Let even the weakling say, 'I'm a warrior.'" See, there's peace in the first half of the tribulation. But then the man of sin, the Antichrist, in the middle of the tribulation arises, and then, Jews, you're going to have to beat your plows into swords. Now, it is amazing to me that you can read Joel 3:10 and come up with the man of sin in the great tribulation. Let me read this verse to you again and see if you see the Antichrist, the man of sin in the great tribulation in Joel 3:10. "Beat your plows into swords and your pruning knives into spears. Let even the weakling say, 'I am a warrior.'" It's not in there, folks. And I go through this little exercise to show you the contrast between a futurist and a preterist interpretation of prophecy. I also went through the dispensationalist argument here to show you the lengths to which dispensationalists will go to speculate about something in the future when nobody has the foggiest notion of what's going to happen in the far-off future. Let's turn now to Joel chapter 3, verse 2. Yahweh continues speaking through Joel, "I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Then I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my inheritance Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have divided up my land." Now, where is this valley of Jehoshaphat? Well, here it's used in a symbolic way, I'm sure. There's a couple of options as to what it is. It could refer to a physical valley in which Jehoshaphat won a great victory. Jehoshaphat ruled from 870 to 848, and in 2 Chronicles 20, verses 22 through 26, Jehoshaphat won a great battle over the Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites, the pagan tribes to the east of the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, and to the south of the Dead Sea. Let's read that. 2 Chronicles 20, verses 22 through 26. "The moment they began their shouts and praises, the Lord set an ambush against the Ammonites, Moabites, and the inhabitants of Mount Seir," that's the Edomites, "who came to fight against Judah, and they were defeated. The Ammonites and Moabites turned against the inhabitants of Mount Seir," that's the Edomites, "and completely annihilated them. When they had finished with the inhabitants of Seir, they helped destroy each other." A lot of friendly fire going on. "When Judah came to a place overlooking the wilderness, they looked for the large army, but there were only corpses lying on the ground. Nobody had escaped. Then Jehoshaphat and his people went to gather the plunder. They found among them an abundance of goods on the bodies and valuable items. So they stripped them until nobody could carry any more. They were gathering the plunder for 3 days because there was so much. They assembled in the valley of Barakah on the fourth day, for there they praised the Lord. Therefore, that place is still called the Valley of Barakah today." Barakah means blessing, the Valley of Blessing. The problem is nobody knows exactly where this is. Here are some options as to where the physical valley is. Near Tekoa, that's the town that Amos was from, about 11 or 12 miles south of Jerusalem, about 5 or 6 miles south of Bethlehem, maybe 4 miles south of Bethlehem, roughly. Now, Wikipedia and Barnes say that that's an option as to where the Valley of Jehoshaphat is. Ellicott affirms it, says that's where it is, near Tekoa. Another option, option number 2, as concerning where the Valley of Jehoshaphat is the Kidron Valley, which is the valley to the east of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives. Wikipedia says that's a viable option. The Encyclopedia of the Bible at least mentions it as an option, maybe even affirms it. Albert Barnes says it's an option. Option number 3, it's the Valley of Jezreel, which is also the Valley of Megiddo, that valley that runs northwest to southeast from Mount Carmel down to the Jordan River, where all kinds of things happen there. The Battle of Harmageddon. Gideon had his battle there in the Valley of Jezreel. I think the Witch of Endor in the valley. Lots of stuff happened there in the Valley of Jezreel. That's option 3 is where the Valley of Jehoshaphat is. Option 4, the Hinnom Valley, which is the Valley of Trash, where they burnt corpses and sacrificed babies to idols, in the valley south of Mount Zion. Well, you can see nobody knows where the Valley of Jehoshaphat is, so we're going to take it symbolically. Jehoshaphat won a great battle in the Valley of Barakah, the Valley of Blessing, and then we go from there to say, okay, well, that was his victory, so we're going to call that the Valley of Jehoshaphat. That's a speculation. The other option is it's symbolic, as Wikipedia mentions as an option. Why is it symbolic? Because there is no such valley in Israel. Adam Clark says, therefore, the name must be symbolic. It's symbolic of a great victory over God's enemies. The meaning of Jehoshaphat shows this because Jehoshaphat in Hebrew means Yahweh judges, as Wikipedia points out. And so that's how we're going to take it. The Valley of Jehoshaphat is where God is going to bring a whole bunch of Gentile nations to judge. Because verse 2 says, then I will enter into judgment with them there, with the nations there, on behalf of Israel. Now these nations, Joel says in verse 2, scattered Israel among the nations. Well, who did that? That would be the Roman Empire. Kyle and Dellett say that Israel was not scattered to the nations until the time of the Romans. Let me quote you from that commentary. Even in Joel's time, many Israelites may no doubt have been scattered about in distant heathen lands, but the heathen nations had not yet cast lots upon the nation as a whole to dispose of the inhabitants as slaves and divide the land among themselves. This was not done till the time of the Romans. Calendelich are referring to the next verse, verse 3, which says, they have also cast lots for my people. Well, if this is true, that fits in with chapter 2, which says that the day of the Lord was the judgment on the Romans in AD 70, and the judgment on the Jews, too, in AD 70. There's a little bit of problem here because we tend to think of AD 70 as a time of judgment on apostate Israel, not upon the Roman Empire. But remember, the Roman Empire went through all kinds of trouble during the Jewish War. In fact, Vespasian was called back from besieging Jerusalem because there was civil war in the Roman Empire in the years 68 through 69 after Nero killed himself. Four emperors fought. Three of them lasted only a few months, and finally the fourth emperor, Vespasian, took over, leaving his son Titus in Jerusalem to finish the destruction of Jerusalem. The temple to Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill was destroyed by fire, I think it was, in 69. So there was a lot of judgment on the nations because the Roman Empire represented the nations of the world. So in verse 2, Yahweh says, I will enter into judgment with them, with the nations, symbolized or represented by the Roman Empire. I will do this on behalf of my people, Israel, whom they, the Romans, have scattered among the nations. That's exactly what the Romans did after AD 70. They sold all those Jews into slavery. I think it was about 1 million of them. I forgot the numbers exactly, but there were a tremendous amount of Jews sold into slavery. And they have divided up my land, referring to the Romans. Yes, that's what they did to Israel. So it fits pretty good, I think, AD 70 and the Romans. But, of course, that's not the only opinion on this. So let's see, what are the options when Joel says, or Yahweh says, I will enter into judgment in the Valley of Jehoshaphat? Well, of course, the typical futurist option is this refers to Christ's second coming. In fact, most of my commentators took that view, that this is all referring to God whacking all the non-believing nations who whack Israel. Now, of course, if you're dispensationalist, that would be physical Israel reconstituted in the millennium. But if you're not a dispensationalist, that would be the new Israel being persecuted by the nations of the world, the church. That's option number one, is when this judgment in the Valley of Jehoshaphat occurs. Option number two is AD 70, which I've just mentioned to you. Let me give you an opinion by a man named Kurt Simmons, and I hate to quote him because I know he was a hyper-preterist heretic, at least for a long time, although I did find a website that said that he's renounced at least a part of that heresy. The name of the article is Kurt Simmons Dropkicks Full Preterist View to the Curb on Resurrection. So at least he's at least halfway orthodox. This is what Simmons says. Joel evokes this valley to foreshow the great deliverance God would work for his people at the time of the eschaton, means the time of the establishment of the church, when Nero, the nations of the Roman Empire, and the Jews were gathered against the church to exterminate it. And then, of course, God whacked Nero, and he whacked the emperors that came afterwards. Now, this view that judgment on the nations, as I said, judgment on the Roman Empire in AD 70 fits the general view of chapter 2 that the time frame that Joel is indicating is AD 70, because in Joel 2, verse 32, we read this, then everyone who calls on the name of Yahweh will be saved, for there will be an escape for those on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, as the Lord promised among the survivors the Lord calls. And those survivors would be the Christians who escaped from Jerusalem to Pella when Cestus Gallius, the Roman general, backed off from his siege. The zealots who were holding the Christians captive in Jerusalem went chasing Cestius Gallus, leaving the Christians in the city to remember the words of Jesus, who said, "When you see the abomination which causes desolation, i.e. the Roman army, surrounding the city, flee." And they fled to Pella, across the Jordan River to the northeast, about 40 miles or so. All of this is recorded by Eusebius of Caesarea, the 4th century famous church historian. So the survivors the Lord calls, there will be an escape for those on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem. That sounds like AD 70. Now, there's a problem with this AD 70 view, because it's the nations who are getting judged in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, not Israel. AD 70 was the judgment on Israel. And as I said earlier, we tend to forget the Romans were judged too, the year of four emperors. Now, Kurt Simmons has an interesting idea of how the pagan nations are judged. He doesn't just refer it to the Romans. He says that Jesus, the Son of God, is judging all the nations now. He quotes John 5:22, "The Father, in fact, judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son." Acts 10:42, "He," that's Jesus, "commanded us," the apostles, "to preach to the people and to solemnly testify that he," Jesus, "is the one appointed by God to be the judge of the living and the dead." So the judgment among the nations is a judgment by King Jesus, who's judging them because the Father gave all judgment to the Son. That's an interesting argument. Kurt Simmons summarizes that argument by saying this: "Whereas God had not undertaken specifically to eradicate idolatry from the nations in former times, he now would, and his wrath is upon any nation that persist in rebellion against the gospel." So Jesus is judging the nations, and the Valley of Jehoshaphat is a symbol of where and how he's doing it all during the church age. So you got a couple ways you can go there if you take a preterist viewpoint. The nations are physically judged in the judgment on the Roman Empire during the Jewish War, the year of four emperors. Or it's Jesus judging the nations as the great judge who will destroy a nation that does not bend its knee to him. Now, I have already mentioned that Colin Delitzsch hold the view that this scattering to the nations that's mentioned in verse 2 here, they, that's the nations, have scattered among the nations. Colin Delitzsch says that has to be only during the Roman Empire. So that's a pretty strong argument for AD 70. So there's your futurist and your preterist options. Let's go to Joel 3, verse 3. "They," that's the nations, "have also cast lots for my people, traded a boy for a harlot and sold a girl for wine that they may drink." In other words, the Romans sold the Jews into slavery. Why did they cast lots? Well, that's so the Roman soldiers could see how many captives each conquering soldier should have. How did they trade a boy for a harlot? A couple of options. They could have pimped out a captive Jewish boy in lieu of a harlot. In other words, they were pimping girls, but then they decided to put a captured Jewish boy slave in place of one of the girl prostitutes. I don't think that's what it is. I think that they would just use a captive Jewish boy to pay the price of a harlot. Maybe even gave the boy slave to the harlot in return for her services. I doubt that. Probably just sold the boy, took the money, and paid the harlot. Also, the Romans sold a girl for wine that they may drink. Again, they could have pimped out the girl, making some money, and then buying the wine with it. Or they could have just sold the girl as a slave and took the money that they may drink. However you interpret this, they did some bad things to the Jews. We go to Joel chapter 3, verse 4. "And also, Tyre, Sidon, and all the territories of Philistia, what are you to me? Are you paying me back, trying to get even with me? I will quickly bring retribution on your heads." Yahweh continues to speak. Now, what he's doing here, he's going back and referring to nations that have given the old Israel a lot of trouble, a lot of oppression. And again, they're all symbolic or representative of the nations that destroyed Israel in AD 70. And Joel is bringing these examples up to say, I took care of these nations back then. I'm going to take care of the Romans for what they did. Although they were my tool, I'm going to execute judgment on my tool. Now, Tyre and Sidon, of course, are the two famous Mediterranean cities on the coast right north of Israel. Philistia, the famous enemies of Israel, on the southwest of Jerusalem, along the coast and inward a little bit, along the Shephelah, the lowlands there, the home of the Philistines. Now, John Gill says that all these places, Tyre, Sidon, and Philistia, are symbolic of all the enemies of Christ. Kurt Simmons, the aforementioned, maybe he's a hyper-preterist heretic, maybe he's not guy, says this, judgment mentioned by Joel should be understood typically as pointing in a general way to the time of Messiah, when his providential rule of the nations would avenge the oppression of his people against their enemies, of which Tyre, Sidon, and Palestine were examples. Palestine is the land of the Philistines. They were examples of this, examples of all the nations who would be opposed to the spread of the gospel after the old Israel was destroyed in AD 70. Now this phrase in verse 4, are you paying me back? What Yahweh is saying here is, are you even thinking of trying to get me back for defeating you? Are you paying me back? Are you really going to do that? No, because I'm quickly going to bring retribution on your heads. Joel 3 verses 5 through 7 we turn to next. Yahweh is still speaking. For you took my silver and gold and carried my finest treasures to your temples. You sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks to remove them far from their own territory. Look, I am about to rouse them up from the place where you sold them. I will bring retribution on your heads. Now in verse 5, Yahweh says, you took my silver. The you, of course, would refer to the three political entities mentioned in verse 4, Tyre, Sidon, and the Philistines. Now we have a little bit of problem here because we need to find out when did these people rob Israel of silver and gold and carry that silver and gold to their territory, as verse 5 says. Well, of those three places, Tyre, Sidon, and Philistia, Philistia is the only example I could find of a nation that carried off Israel's silver and gold. I'm going to read 2 Chronicles 21, 16 through 17 in just a minute, and I'll show you that. John Gill says there's no historical evidence that Tyre took Israel's gold, and I'm assuming there's no historical evidence that Sidon did either. So we have a little problem there. Now, one way you can solve it is when you say for you, you just say the you refers to the Philistines, because 2 Chronicles 21 does tell us the Philistines carried off some gold. And so you lump all that group together, and the Philistines represent that group, and they took off the gold, and that's the easiest way to solve it as far as I'm concerned. Now, let's look at options as to who it was that took off the silver and gold. Now, the commentators give these options, and I don't really understand it because it seems to me the you refers to Tyre, Sidon, and Philistia. But let me give you these options anyway. The Romans after AD 70. How does the you refer to Romans in AD 70? I guess in verse 2 we said that the Romans had divided up the land. They had scattered the Jews among the nations, and then you could make the you go back and refer to that. And that is true. The Romans carried the silver and gold away, I'm sure. Another option that's been mentioned is the Babylonians carried off silver and gold of Israel in 586. But again, how does the you refer to Babylonians? Well, let's go to option number 3, and we'll see the Philistines did carry off gold, along with their buddies the Arabians. They did this when they robbed King Jehoram's house. Jehoram was the ruler of northern Israel, who ruled from 848 to 841. And let's read about what happened in 2 Chronicles 21, verses 16 through 17. The Lord put it into the mind of the Philistines and the Arabs who lived near the Cushites. Cushites are Ethiopians south of Egypt, and Arabs would be those living in the desert around that area, maybe across the Red Sea and the Arabian Peninsula. But at any rate, the Philistines is who we're mainly concerned with. God put it into the mind of the Philistines and the Arabs to attack Jehoram, who ruled from 848 to 841. So they went to war against Judah and invaded it. They carried off all the possessions found in the king's palace. That would include gold and silver. And also Jehoram's sons and wives. Not a son was left to Jehoram except Jehoahaz, his youngest son. Now, of course, after the Philistines carried off that gold and silver, it's possible the Tyrians and the Sidonians then bought some of that treasure. So then you could say in verse 5, for you took my silver and gold, the Philistines by stealing it, and the Tyrians and the Sidonians by buying it, and carried thereupon my finest treasures to your temples. Option number 4 as to who carried off Judah's silver and gold would be the Syrians. Again, I don't know why you would refer to Syrians. Where's the referent to that? Where's the antecedent to that pronoun? But we know the Syrians did that. 1 Kings 15:18, Asa 9:11-8:70, withdrew all the silver and gold that remained in the treasuries of the Lord's temple and the treasuries of the royal palace and put it into the hands of his servants. Then King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, who, of course, is a Syrian king in Damascus. So Asa lost some of his silver and gold. So did King Joash, who ruled from 835 to 796. King Joash of Judah, this is in 2 Kings 12:18. King Joash of Judah took all the consecrated items that his ancestors had consecrated, along with his own consecrated items, and all the gold found in the treasures of the Lord's temple and in the king's palace, and sent them to Hazael, king of Aram, king of Syria. So the Syrians took a lot of gold. But again, you have that pronoun there for "you took my silver and gold." So I'm going to say it's the Philistine. "You sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks," in verse 6. Now, Greeks is literally the sons of Javan, I guess you might want to say, Javan. The Columbia Encyclopedia says of Javan, he's Japheth's son. That's the third son of Noah, Japheth is. And where it is an unidentified place engaged in trade with Tyre, perhaps a Greek colony. So in other words, it might not be Greece. It might not be Greeks, but it probably is. The Holman Christian Study Bible says it's the Greeks. So when did the Philistines, the Tyrians, and the Sidonians sell Jewish slaves to the Greeks? Well, Kurt Simmons and Albert Barnes say this occurred during the time of Jehoram of Judah, who ruled from 848 to 841, that same Jehoram we just mentioned, when the Philistines invaded. The Edomites also revolted during Jehoram's rule. At any rate, it's likely that the Jewish captives who were taken during that invasion were then sold to the Greeks, probably by way of Tyre and Sidon, because they were involved in slave trading. And if that's the case, verse 5 is taking care of the antecedent for "you. You sold the people." That would refer to the Tyrians and the Sidonians, and the "you" would also refer to the Philistines carrying off the treasures in the times of King Jehoram. Now, how do we know that the Greeks were involved in slave trading? Tyre and Sidon, I think, were famous for that, but we read in Ezekiel 27, verse 13, Javan, that's the Greeks, Tubal and Meshech were in Anatolia, present-day Turkey, were your, Ezekiel's talking to Tyre now, were your Tyre's merchants. They exchanged slaves for your goods. In other words, Javan, Greece, and Tyre exchanged slaves. Now, of course, that has the slave trading going in the opposite direction from Greece back to Tyre. But nonetheless, they were involved in the slave trade. This is what Benson says about this slave trading of the Greeks. "It was customary for the merchants of the neighboring countries, particularly of Tyre and Sidon, to buy the children of Israel for slaves of their conquerors in order to sell them again. The histories which record the calamities of the Jews speak of great numbers of them being made captives and then sold and dispersed into foreign countries. Thus, 40,000 were sold by Antiochus Epiphanes, and about 97,000 at the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus." Benson quotes 1 Maccabees 3, verse 41, "And the merchants of the country, hearing the fame of them, took silver and gold very much, with servants, with slaves, and came into the camp to buy the children of Israel for slaves. A power also of Syria and of the land of the Philistines joined themselves unto them." That's 2nd century B.C., with the Maccabees involved in slave trading. Not the Maccabees weren't involved in slave trading, but Syria and the Philistines were involved in trading Jewish slaves. All right, returning to Joel 3, verses 5, 6, and 7, we see that Jewish slaves had been sold to the Greeks. I'm speculating the Philistines had taken Jewish slaves, sold them to Tyre. Tyre sold them to the Greeks. In verse 7, Yahweh says, "Look, I am about to rouse them up from the place where you sold them. I will bring retribution on your heads." God says, "I'm about to rouse up the people of Judah and Jerusalem from Greece where they were sold." When did that happen? Well, here are some options. Option number one, this refers to Alexander the Great and his successors. Gill mentions that as a possibility. Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown affirm it, as do Simmons and Benson. Simmons says the Jews who had been detained captives in other countries were set free by the successors of Alexander the Great, particularly by Demetrius, as Josephus relates. And it's well known that Alexander the Great liked the Jews, and the Jews liked Alexander the Great. And so that's a reasonable option. Option number two, this arousing of the Jews out of Greece, where they had been sold into captivity, could be the future restoration of the Jews out of all countries unto their own land. But it says Greece, not all countries. Option number three, the gathering together of the spiritual Israel, or the people of God, who have been persecuted from place to place by their anti-Christian enemies. Well, I think options number two and three are a little bit too loose for me. Future restoration of the Jews out of Greece? No, out of all countries, says this option. I don't think so. Or the gathering together of the spiritual Israel, people of God. That's a little loose, too, because it says they're going to be aroused out of Greece. So I think the option that says this refers to the fact that the generals under Alexander the Great, following Alexander the Great, were very favorable toward the Jews and turned them loose, as most of my commentators say. We go now to Joel 3, verse 8. Yahweh continues, "Also I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the sons of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabaeans, to a distant nation, for the Lord has spoken." Now the "your" there is referring to Tyre. "I will sell your Tyre sons," because back in verse 4, also Tyre, Sidon, and all the territories of Philistia are mentioned, and of the Tyre and Sidonians, and of that group of Tyrians and Sidonians and Philistians, we have an instance of where the Tyrians were sold by the Jews. Now, this is how this works. This is from Gill, Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, and Barnes. When Alexander the Great took the city of Tyre, remember he built a mole between the old city of Tyre on the mainland and the new city of Tyre on an island in the Mediterranean Sea. He took both of those cities of Tyre, and thousands of Tyrians were then sold for slaves. Alexander then put some of these slaves into the hands of the Jews, because the Jews were friends with Alexander the Great, as I just said. So that means Tyrians are now under the control of Jews. The Jews have Tyrians as slaves, and then they will sell them to the Sabaeans. Well, where's Sabaea? Verse 8 says it's a distant nation. Sabaea is probably Sheba, or possibly Sheba. It was reckoned by the Jews to be the uttermost part of the earth. As Joel says in verse 8, it was a distant nation. We read, of course, about the Queen of Sheba in Matthew 12, verse 42. "The Queen of the South," that's the Queen of Sheba, "will rise up with its generation at the judgment and will condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon." Jeremiah 6:20 says, "For what purpose does frankincense come to me from Sheba, and the sweet cane from a distant land?" Well, Sheba is speculated to be at the extreme end of the Arabian Peninsula, towards the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf, in other words, at the southwestern corner of the Arabian Peninsula, where modern-day Yemen is. In fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible note for Sabaea says it's modern Yemen. Now, some people say it's not precisely there. It's really Arabia Deserta, which is Arabia Magna, which is the whole Saudi Arabian Peninsula. Keep going north till you hit Jordan, all the way up to Syria. It doesn't really matter. The point is, the Tyrians are going to be sold into slavery to a place far, far away, and they're going to pay for their purchasing of Jewish slaves. Now, selling slaves to the Sabaeans is not unlikely, since the Jews traded with Sabaeans for spices, so it's very easy to conceive how they could sell their captives to the Sabaeans in the course of that trade. We go now to Joel chapter 3, verses 9 through 12. Yahweh continues to speak through Joel. "Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare a war. Rouse the mighty men. Let all the soldiers draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, 'I am a mighty man.' Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Bring down, O Lord, your mighty ones. Let the nations be aroused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations." Now, verse 9, Yahweh says to prepare a war. That's the NASB translation. The literal word there is to sanctify a war. Heathens always preceded their wars with religious ceremonies, and so is Israel to do here the same way. Rouse the mighty men, the soldiers. Let all the soldiers draw near. Let them come up. In other words, let's muster the soldiers. Verse 10, beat your plowshares into swords. Now that's the opposite of what Isaiah and Micah said in their famous prophecies. And your pruning hooks into spears. A pruning hook, I'm not exactly sure, it's some kind of farming implement. It was used for farming, but it was to be beaten into a spear to be used for military purposes. Likewise, a plowshare. A plowshare is a plow. Hammer that out into a sword. In other words, quit being rustic, peaceful, bucolic farmers and turn into bloodthirsty warriors. Now, that's the opposite of what Isaiah said in Isaiah 2, verses 2 through 4. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be established at the top of the mountains and will be raised above the hills. All nations will stream to it, and many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways so that we may walk in his paths. For instruction will go out of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will settle disputes among the nations and provide arbitration for many peoples. They will turn their swords into plows." That's the opposite way. Military weapons are being turned back into farming implements, and their spears, another military weapon, being turned back into pruning knives. Nations will not take up the sword against other nations, and they will never again train for war. Now, I think that that is a prophecy of the establishment of the church. The ultimate fulfillment of the church age, of course, will be when nation will not take up sword against another nation. We're not there yet, but I think this is what Isaiah is getting at. But before those happy times will happen, notice the opposite has got to happen. The plowshares have got to be beaten into swords because the nations have to be judged before nations will not take up the sword against one another again. And so Joel is saying, get ready for war, guys. And again, I believe this is all symbolic of a war against the enemies of Israel, both old and new Israel. It's symbolic. The nations are against the people of God, both old and new. And so they're going to be judged in a symbolic valley called the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where Yahweh judges, because that's what the name means. Micah has the same idea as Isaiah. He says in Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, in the last days, and again, last days is usually means the end of the nation of Israel before the Messiah comes, or maybe you can say at the beginning of the time of the Messiah. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be established at the top of the mountains and will be raised above the hills. Peoples will stream to it. That's people coming into the church. And many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways so that we may walk in his paths. For instruction will go out of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." That's the Christian gospel. "He will settle disputes among many peoples and provide arbitration for strong nations that are far away. They will beat their swords into plows and their spears into pruning knives. Nation will not take up the sword against nation, and they will never again train for war. But each man will sit under his grapevine and under his fig tree with no one to frighten him. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has promised it." For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has promised this. Once again, we see the swords, the military weapons are beaten back into plows, the farming weapons, backwards of what Joel says. In verse 10, Joel says, "Let the weak say he's a mighty man." Couple of options on how you can read that. That could refer ironically to deluded opponents of God who think they are strong. Let the deluded opponents of Yahweh say, "I'm a mighty man. I don't care. I'm going to wipe them out." I don't think that's what Joel meant. I think it refers directly to the friends of God who think they aren't up to this great battle against the nations. Oh yes, you need to be strong. You need to say who you are, that you are a mighty man. Verse 11, "Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations. Gather yourselves there in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Come on in so you can get judged. Bring down, O Lord, your mighty ones." That's probably God's angels. It could be his human soldiers. "Let the nations be aroused and come up to the Valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations." Now, if this is the Roman Empire getting judged for what they did to Jesus by killing him, it very well could be, as I've been trying to make the case for, but if you want to take it as happening in the future, that's all right, because history really repeats itself. The pagan nations are always opposed to God. Look at the world today. You can take any time in history, pagan nations are always opposing God, and sooner or later, God's going to judge them all. Now, verse 12 says, "Let the nations be aroused and come up to the Valley of Jehoshaphat." Remember, the Valley of Jehoshaphat is mentioned in one other place in the Bible, actually. One other place in Joel. In fact, one other place in this chapter, which is verse 2 of chapter 3. That verse reads, "I will gather all the nations and take them to the Valley of Jehoshaphat. I will enter into judgment with them there because of my people, my inheritance, Israel. The nations have scattered the Israelites in foreign countries and divided up my land." The Romans did that. That could be a type of what the nations have done to the church. So the options as to what this Valley of Jehoshaphat is, two options. It could be the last battle between Christ and his enemies. In fact, almost all of my commentators say it is this. They take a very futurist view of it. Or it could be option number two, that God is judging the nations in the Roman Empire after that empire destroyed the old Israel in AD 70. They're going to pay for that. We go now to Joel 3, verses 13 through 17. Put in the sickle, Yahweh says, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread, for the winepress is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the Valley of Decision. And the Valley of Decision is not non-Christians in a football stadium trying to decide if they are going to heed an evangelist call. The Valley of Decision is the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where the nations are being judged. Not saved, judged. For the day of the Lord is near in the Valley of Decision. Again, day of the Lord, we said in chapter 2, was most probably AD 70. That's why I tend to want to carry that over as a contextual matter into Joel chapter 3. The day of the Lord is near in the Valley of Decision. Verse 15 says, the sun and moon grow dark and the stars lose their brightness. Again, that's typical decreation rhetoric prophets use to show regime change. The Roman Empire is going to be judged, and all of the nations of the world will be judged. Old Israel is going down so that the new Israel, the church, might be established. Ah, but you say, Joel is mainly concerned about judgment on the nations who are in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. That's not old Israel, that's the nations. That's the Roman Empire. Well, remember, Rome was judged at this time too. The year of the four emperors occurred in the years 68 to 69. The empire came very close to being destroyed. Let me give you a quote from Tacitus. Upon this year, disgraced by so many deeds of shame, heaven also set its mark by tempest and by disease. Campania, that's the area south of Rome, was wasted by a whirlwind, which far and wide wrecked the farms, the fruit trees, and the crops, and carried its fury to the neighborhood of the capital, Rome, where all classes of men were being decimated by a deadly epidemic. No outward sign of a distempered air was visible. Yet the houses were filled with lifeless bodies, the streets with funerals. Neither sex nor age gave immunity from danger. Slaves and freeborn populace alike were summarily cut down amid the laments of their wives and children, who, themselves inflicted while tending or mourning the victims, were often burnt upon the same pyre. Knights and senators, though they perished on all hands, were less deplored, as if, by undergoing the common lot, they were cheating the ferocity of the emperor. That's pretty bad. So, Roman Empire was being judged. That's judgment rhetoric. Sun and moon growing dark, stars losing their brightness. Heavens and earth trembling, verse 16. The Lord roars from Zion. Zion, of course, is Mount Zion, where the temple is. God lives in the temple, and so his mouth comes from there. He utters his voice from Jerusalem, and as a result, the heavens and the earth tremble. Everything trembles. Notice that there's a shaking of heaven and earth in Hebrews. Hebrews 12, verses 26 and 27. His voice shook the earth at that time, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also heaven. This expression, yet once more, indicates the removal of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what is not shaken might remain. Now, I'm convinced that Hebrews 12 is talking about the end of the Roman Empire. Now, I'm convinced that Hebrews 12 is talking about the end of apostate Jerusalem, apostate Israel. You might also notice that sun and moon growing dark type of rhetoric is in Jesus' Olivet Discourse, which I'm even more certain referred to AD 70. And so all that fits, this doom and gloom, not only on the Jews, but on the Romans. Remember, the two persecuting entities in the book of Revelation were the sea beast, the Roman Empire, and the land beast, the apostate Jewish kingdom who killed Jesus. And here, Joel is concentrating on the destruction of the Romans. In verse 16, but the Lord is a refuge for his people and a stronghold to the sons of Israel, because he destroys the old Israel in order to give birth to the new Israel. Verse 17, then you will know that I am the Lord your God dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Of course, Mount Zion is where the temple is. Mount Moriah is right to the north of Mount Zion. It's part of the same little hill there. And the temple was there, and that's where God lived. He dwelled in Zion. So Jerusalem will be holy, set apart. Apart from the world, set apart to God, and strangers will pass through it no more. And I believe that's referring to the new Jerusalem, the church, the heavenly Jerusalem. It comes down from out of heaven. It will be holy. It will be set apart to God, consecrated, and strangers will pass through it no more. In other words, even as the old Israel keeps getting invaded by enemies, that's not going to happen to the church, because strangers can no longer enter the spiritual Zion, the church. We go now to Joel chapter 3, verses 18 through 21, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues, "In that day the mountains will drip with sweet wine, and the hills will flow with milk. All the streams of Judah will flow with water, and a spring will issue from the Lord's house, watering the valley of Achishah. Egypt will become desolate, and Edom a desert wasteland, because of the violence done to the people of Judah, in whose land they shed innocent blood. But Judah will be inhabited forever, and Jerusalem from generation to generation. I will pardon their blood guilt, which I have not pardoned, for the Lord dwells in Zion." Now these verses speak of the establishment of the church, the new Jerusalem. The nations have been judged, the Roman Empire specifically, that crucified Jesus, been judged. And as a result, the church springs forth under the metaphors of sweet wine and milk flowing down the hills. Now, I read somewhere some crazed literalist, hyper-literalist, he said that wine and milk would bubble up from fountains in the millennium. Well, that's just nonsense. This is poetic language. I hope that all literalist dispensationalists are not that literal. I know that there are some that are somewhat more reasonable than that, but I just point that out to show you there's a lot of crazy stuff out there, people taking things literally. You know, the moon turns to blood. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody would say, yeah, man, we could go up there and do blood transfusions because the moon will be blood, literally. The streams of Judah will flow with water in a spring. Well, springs, of course, and living water, flowing water, is the typical symbol of the Holy Spirit, the church. Jesus said your bellies will be full of living water. Now, all this will happen in that day, in verse 18. When is this time of happiness? Here are the options again. Time of the Maccabees? I don't think so. The New Covenant Age? I do think so. Gill and Clark say so. The Millennium, as Guzik and the Futurist will say. Or it could just refer to the return from Babylon, but I think it's got a wider application than just that return from Babylon. I think it's talking about the church, especially in verse 21. We read that, "I will pardon their blood guilt." That's what happens to people in the church. Their sins, their blood guiltiness is pardoned, forgiven. Their blood guiltiness is pardoned, forgiven. "For the Lord dwells in Zion." Zion, of course, is a symbol in the New Testament for the church, Hebrews 12, 22. Adam Clark says it refers to the church here, but Hebrews 12:22 says, "But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels." Mount Zion, the city of the living God. The author of Hebrews is talking to Christians. Mount Zion is the church. "The Lord dwells in Zion. The Lord dwells in his church, and he will pardon our blood guilt." So Judah will be inhabited forever in Jerusalem from generation to generation. That didn't happen physically because even though the Jews recovered the land in about 538 when they returned from Babylon, they lost it again to the Romans in, what was that, 63 B.C., and they never got it back until 1948. That's a big gap. But verse 20 says, "Judah will be inhabited forever and Jerusalem from generation to generation," so I take that to be he's talking about the church. Now, a couple of minor points, and we'll finish up. "A spring will issue from the Lord's house," verse 18 says, "watering the valley of acacias," or the Shittim Valley, depending on your translation. The Shittim tree was the acacia tree, and I've seen these trees in Israel, kind of brownish-looking, stubbly, kind of bushy-looking. Where is the valley of the acacias? Well, it's a plain or a valley that was near the Jordan River upon the borders of Moab, east of the Jordan River, near Mount Nebo, where Moses died. This is from BibleStudyTools.com. "And the shittim tree grew there, from which came shittim wood. The building material of much of the tabernacle was shittim wood." And many think that shittim is the same thing as acacia, thus the translation here, the valley of the acacias. It just means that the water that's coming from the Lord's house will water these beautiful acacia trees and bring prosperity and flourishing growth. On the other hand, in verse 19, "Egypt will become desolate and Edom a desert wasteland." Those are your two typical enemies of Israel. They're wiped out. And again, they stand for all the enemies of the Church of Christ eventually. They actually did get wiped out by the Romans. The Romans controlled Egypt and Edom. Well, I know they controlled Egypt. I think they tried to control Edom. But at any rate, those two countries are gone, and they are everywhere in the Old Testament as enemies of Israel. They're gone, but Judah will be inhabited forever. The church will last forever. One last translation issue in verse 21. Yahweh says, "I will pardon their blood guilt," Judah and Jerusalem's blood guilt. Pardon. That word is not translated pardon in all the translations. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. The NASB has, I will avenge their blood guiltiness. The KJV and the ASV says, I will cleanse their blood guiltiness. That translation fits in well with the idea of Christ's blood cleansing the sins of those in the church. I will cleanse their blood guiltiness. Bible in Basic English says, I will send punishment, whatever that means. Darby's translation says, I will purge their blood guiltiness. God's word says, I will punish their blood guiltiness. And the Young's Literal translation says, declared their blood innocent. So now I have a question. How in the world can the proper translation be that God will punish them when he's just been talking about delivering them and making the wine and the milk flow? I don't know. I think that's off the wall. We'll go with pardon. God's going to pardon the sins of Zion, the sins of Christians in the church, so that they will walk free and clean of their blood guiltiness. So basically the idea is I will pardon them, I will forgive them. So ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Joel chapter 3 and the whole book of Joel. We are now prepared to go to our next minor prophet, which is the book of Amos. I hope you stay with me as we delve into chapter 1 in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this session.